Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, with fuel-laden forest in the Sierra foothills and beyond, why haven't we seen more disasters like the campfire? We return to the podcast California Burning to find out. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. For Veterans Day, we look at the legacy of the nation's first African-American national park superintendent, back when the U.S. Army managed the parks. Born into slavery, Colonel Charles Young later served his country in Haiti, Liberia, and Mexico.
But first, this week's news. Governor Gavin Newsom is in Fresno today for the 2019 California Economic Summit. He's the keynote speaker of the two-day event that focuses on how statewide collaborations can help more people achieve prosperity, or the California dream.
Also this week, California's oldest dairy has closed. Hanford's Giacomazzi Dairy shut down milk production last month and auctioned off its cattle. Owner Dino Giacomazzi says it's been difficult to stay afloat with increasing regulations, stagnating milk prices, and rising costs. He's now switching out the cows for almonds, a decision he says wasn't easy since his family dairy has been in operation since 1893.
When you're doing one thing for, over 100 years, there's a lot of identity in that and a lot of emotion, I think, built around that decision.
Babies born before 37 weeks are considered preterm. And for the fifth year in a row, a report from the nonprofit March of Dimes ranked Fresno and Kern counties among the worst in the state for preterm birth, where between 9% and 10% of babies are born premature. That's better than the national rate, but it doesn't bode well for specific communities, says March of Dimes Regional Director Shante Davies-Bulch.
But overall, California is not doing bad. The crisis is in the racial and ethnic disparities.
For instance, in Fresno in 2016, Black and Native American babies were more than 75% more likely to be born preterm than white babies.
The former CEO of a Merced area healthcare organization was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison for committing healthcare fraud and conspiracy to receive kickbacks. Sandra Haar, who operated Horizons Unlimited, pleaded guilty to the charges last year. In addition to serving time, she owes over $6 million in fines.
Also yesterday, Fresno City Council members Mike Carbasi, Gary Bredefeld, and Mayor Lee Brand introduced an ordinance that would punish those who share materials from closed sessions without approval from the City Council.
I'm going to dub this legislation the Councilmember Carbasi Snitches Get Stitches Act, for the record.
That was Councilman Luis Chavez, who thinks the ordinance might put the city attorney in a compromising position. Since its initial proposition, language was added to clarify protections for whistleblowers who take concerning materials to law enforcement. No action was taken on the ordinance.
Catch more local news every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered.
The role immigrants play in this country is a huge and sometimes heated topic of debate these days, especially with the upcoming 2020 election and census. Over the next year, we're going to spend some time sharing profiles of immigrants and their families in the San Joaquin Valley. FM 89's Monica Velez brings us this audio postcard of a mother-daughter team of community advocates in the farming town of Lindsay.
Irma Medellin left Mexico in 1988 to find work in the San Joaquin Valley. When she first arrived in Lindsay, she says she kept to herself mostly. She picked olives and apples. She worked as a seamstress and at some restaurants. But it wasn't until she joined the immigrant photography project at a local school a decade later that she started really interacting with her community.
Entonces ese trabajo me dio la oportunidad That job gave me the opportunity to see that there's a lot of us here who are just like me, who came with the same expectations of a better life.
The goal of the project was to capture the stories of migrants through photos. And she says for her, it was important to change a narrative she'd often hear.
Mucha gente dice, ay, pues, los inmigrantes vienen a quitarnos los trabajos.
A lot of people say, oh, well, the immigrants come to take our jobs or they're dependent on services like food stamps. But it's not like that. We come here to work hard.
She took black and white photos of families, farm workers, houses, and animals. One thing she noticed right away was that a lot of young people in her community who spoke Spanish as their native language couldn't actually read it or write in it.
So eso me dio a mí, pues no me gustó porque si yo...
So that made me, well, I didn't like it because for me, I went to school. I can read and write. And if it was hard for me to be here with all the changes, for someone who can't read or write in their own language, that's difficult.
So she started teaching reading and writing classes. Soon people recognized her and told her about other concerns. Medellin says she didn't always know the answers to people's problems, but she tried to figure it out. And she says that's how she became a community organizer. In 2003, she took it a step further and founded El Quinto Sol de América.
Para nosotros lo más importante es, y la meta, el goal es promover la participación.
For us, the most important thing is civic engagement. That's our goal. We work closely with people in the community and in unincorporated areas. More than 15 years ago, these communities were totally invisible.
And Medellin's life work has been to make sure places like Tonyville, Tuleyville, and El Rancho are seen and heard. A typical day for the 55-year-old is just talking to people, asking what they need. With the help of her daughter, Isabel Arroyo Toland, now the executive director of the organization, she has worked with the county to get bus stops, streetlights, and even paved roads.
Our work is really, we facilitate, we provide the leadership, the resource. We are not the experts, we know that. So we partner with the experts.
That's 36-year-old Arroyo Toland. She drives around the unincorporated town surrounding Lindsay in her royal blue Honda.
And whatever the issue is, we try to bring those resources to the community and then facilitate the process and the discussion. See, this is new here, this sign. The speed limit sign is also new. This sign here as well.
Putting in stop signs and population signs may seem like small victories, she says, but they help frame a community, give it relevance.
Because then it makes you visible. It makes you like, oh, that's my community. You know, and people kind of see it like, oh, that's Plainview, or that's Tonyville, that's Tuleyville. That's why these population signs were so important for community members. Mm-hmm.
Back at El Quinto Sol's office in Lindsay, Medellin looks through some of the old pictures she took for the photography project decades ago. She reminisces about how her organizing work got started and why she chose the name El Quinto Sol de América.
El Quinto Sol, tiempo de transformación.
El Quinto Sol is time for transformation, to be human, to be better.
She says the name resonates with her because it's important to transform places, to help each other find solutions instead of feeling alone. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
If you or a family member immigrated to the U.S. and want to share your story, get in touch. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. The Camp Fire was the most destructive fire in California's history and the world's most costly disaster of 2018. 19,000 homes were destroyed. At least 86 people were killed. But with so many fuel-laden forests in our Sierra foothills and beyond, why haven't we seen more disasters of this scale? Matt Fidler, the creator of the podcast and radio series California Burning, asked that question and explores the answer with us today.
There are hundreds of fire-prone towns like Paradise in the California foothills. After the campfire, I wanted to know not only why Paradise burnt so badly, but after doing more than a year of reporting on our fuel-loaded forests, why other high-fire risk towns haven't been destroyed by fire. It was a question I posed to fire geographer Zeke Lunder.
Historically, the towns are still there because maybe we've got like one day per decade where you've got the weather conditions that could support a large destructive fire. You can have hazardous conditions, but unless you have the ignitions to start a fire, then nothing happens.
This is why this kind of large-scale devastation from wildfire hasn't been common in the past.
But with these longer and longer fire seasons and these longer and longer dry periods, it just suddenly, you go from maybe you had the conditions one day a decade to maybe now you have the conditions one day a year or 2 days a year. And so you've got, you know, suddenly you're like 10 or 20 times more likely to have that bad combination of weather, dryness, and ignition that's going to cause the next campfire. Things are changing, and a lot of it has to do with that, the length of window that we're kind of exposed to that risk.
To understand these changing conditions, I reached out to my colleague Dave Shloem. He's a science communicator and host of NSPR's science show, Blue Dot.
Because the climate is warming, you are getting a much longer fire season. In other words, it's getting warmer and drier earlier in the spring and later in the fall. So that fire season is lengthening. The real key thing to look at to me is the overnight low temperatures. You can see that there has been a steady trend of those going up. And that's really the signature of climate change in California. And coupled with that, of course, the high temperatures during the day, those dry out vegetation stress the plants, and then coupled with the drought we had there for several years, you know, created the catastrophic situation we've had since, you know, basically from 2012 to 2018.
And this added stress from drought and higher temperatures makes trees more susceptible to pests like the now infamous bark beetle, which are killing trees all over the West Coast, making fire conditions worse.
You know, you can definitely see it if you fly over the forests, in like, you know, from, say, Denver to California. You can see the devastation of the brown trees killed by the bark beetles. And what's happening is because the temperatures in winter are warming, those overnight lows are not cold enough to cause the, you know, long periods of freezing that would kill off a lot of these beetle larvae in the wintertime, they're able to survive and then breed and infest more and more forests.
Now, the bark beetle is a native species here, and they play an important part in maintaining our forests. But when the weather conditions change like this, there's nothing to keep them in check.
It's the overnight lows, in the wintertime especially, that's not controlling the bark beetle like it used to. You know, they're a natural part of the ecosystem, or they used to be, but now that ecosystem is changing because of the warming temperatures, and the bark beetles are starting to kill more and more trees.
Science can predict a lot about wildfire. For more science-related wildfire answers like these, go to californiaburning.net or wherever you get your podcasts. In Chico, California, I'm Matt Fidler.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. For many residents of rural California, a higher education seems out of reach. This is especially true for counties that lack a community college or a public university. For this story, we're going to take you north of the San Joaquin Valley to Amador County, where a unique scholarship fund is now providing an educational stepping stone for residents who want to work in mental health. As part of the California Dream Collaboration, Sammy Keola of CAP Radio reports on this solution to a statewide problem.
About a dozen students trickle into Amador County's Learning Center and take a seat for orientation. They range in age from early 20s to late 50s. All but one are women.
Yeah, I'm Bailey, and this is my last class for the certificate.
I'm Jessica. I have four kids, eight and under.
My name is Tiffany, and to be honest with you, most of my life I've been in active addiction. I've been to prison.
They're all after the same thing. A credential in human services, which can open the door to entry-level jobs in health and social work. For the last 5 years, Amador County has covered tuition for people who want to pursue this specialty. They take courses online through Coastline Community College in Orange County. The scholarship board looks for residents with a personal tie to mental illness or substance abuse.
We have a great need in Amador County for trained people who can deal with the issues that we have here.
Meg Newell is with the Amador Community College Foundation, the nonprofit that runs the Learning Center. She says the goal is to create a pipeline of people with lived experience to fill gaps in the county's health workforce. They've given out 44 scholarships so far. About a third of students have graduated or are already working in the field. Six more will graduate this fall with either certificates or associate's degrees in human services.
The scholarship program trains our next generation of social workers and human services experts, but it's also pulling from the community that needs those resources.
When Tammy Montgomery heard about this option in 2017, she was struggling with depression and PTSD. She lost 3 children in a car accident a decade ago, and then her home burned down in the Butte Fire of 2015.
We lost even the baby albums, the pictures, everything. So it was really bad at the time, and I did not deal with it well.
So she moved to Amador and decided to go back to school at age 56. It was her first class in 25 years. And even filling out the online application was a struggle.
She came over, she goes, "You're done?" And I'm like, "I don't know how to turn the computer on."
After a year of help from the Community College Foundation, Montgomery became the student rep on the nonprofit's board and began tutoring other learners. She got her human services certificate and will finish her associate's degree this spring.
And then just scroll up.
On a recent evening at the center, she was huddled over a laptop showing a new student how to install a grammar app for essay writing.
You need the bookmark it thingy right here.
Okay. Amador is one of a handful of counties leveraging a special pot of state mental health dollars to create what's known as peer support workers. With a certificate, they can work with addiction recovery centers, clinics, or other agencies. The hope is for these workers to make a small dent in a mental health worker shortage that's worse in rural California. But unlicensed community workers alone can't solve the problem. Janet Kaufman is a health policy expert at UC San Francisco.
Having folks in the system with lived experience who really understand what it's like is very important. But, you know, they don't have extensive training in psychotherapy. What I would say is I think we need to make investments in the behavioral health workforce up and down the line.
Still, in rural communities like Amador, peer support training creates a pathway for people with limited options. Tammy Montgomery is volunteering with a hospice group. She goes to schools to work with grieving children.
It really got me out and started my life over again. It gave me something to do for a purpose.
California is one of only 2 states in the country that doesn't have a standard certification process for peer support workers in mental health. Governor Gavin Newsom just vetoed a bill that would have expanded this workforce, citing funding concerns. Sammy Kaola, Cap Radio News.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Alice Daniel. This Veterans Day, a portion of Highway 198 next to Sequoia National Park is getting a new name in honor of Colonel Charles Young. He's the first African American to serve as superintendent of a national park and achieve the rank of colonel in the U.S. Army. To learn more about Charles Young and his legacy, FM89's Kathleen Schock spoke with Yosemite National Park Service Ranger Shelton Johnson and author and historian Brian Shellum. We'll also hear from Ravier Kelly, a descendant of Colonel Young.
So, Brian, I understand that Colonel Young was born into slavery, yet went on to study at West Point. Can you fill in the gaps? How did he make this remarkable transition?
Okay, so he was born to enslaved parents in Maeslick, Kentucky in 1864. His father, Gabriel, succeeded on his second attempt to escape north to Ohio, took his wife, Arminta, and son Charles, who was about 6 months old at the time, with them, and they settled around in Brown County around Ripley, Ohio, and he was a bright young man. His mother was one of those rare African Americans at the time who was educated, and so she homeschooled Charles Young, and then he went off to school. They eventually moved to Ripley, Ohio, because there were good schools there. He graduated in 1880 or 1881. He taught at the local black school for about 2 years, and then he competed for a nomination to West Point. And so he began West Point in 1885, and so that's kind of, in a nutshell, how he got from D being enslaved in Kentucky to West Point.
It's an amazing story, but that's really just the beginning. Shelton Johnson, you spoke at length about Colonel Young's legacy with the National Parks as part of Ken Burns' famous documentary. Tell us a little bit about that part of Colonel Young's journey and some of the legacy that he has left with the U.S. National Parks.
Well, one thing that's important to keep in mind is that when people think of National Park Rangers, they think of them as they exist today. They're not thinking about who preceded the National Park Service in a governing sense within Yellowstone, within Sequoia, within Yosemite National Park. So the Army actually was provided that role. And so the ranger hat that we think of that has become so famous throughout the world, well, that hat is a cavalry hat. And so because the first protectors of the national parks, starting in the late 1880s in Yellowstone National Park, and then continuing after 1890 in Yosemite and Sequoia, the first rangers were these soldiers who were protecting the parks before there was any such thing as a National Park Service. So what we've inherited from the Army within this agency that's called the National Park Service, we've inherited a look. We've inherited that hat, that ranger hat that is so familiar to people throughout the world that visit our national parks. That hat came from or stems from the United States Army, and in particular a cavalry hat, although infantry served here as well. And so when I think of Charles Young, I think that he was born in 1864, I immediately have a lens through which I see how it relates to the parks. In 1864 was the year that President Abraham Lincoln set aside Yosemite Valley with the Yosemite Grant. So I see that connection already to Charles Young in the same year that he was actually born. So much of what we think of when we think of the National Park Ranger is rooted literally in the United States Army, in that military experience. And when I'm talking to visitors and they're saying to me, so why was the Army brought in? I mean, they look at me, they have this kind of look of befuddlement to some degree, because we look at the Army today through a lens that's different than how the Army was perceived 100 years ago. If you were a graduate of West Point in the 19th century, you were a graduate of the premier school of engineering in the United States. And West Point essentially was started by Thomas Jefferson for the purpose of building a new nation. And so these weren't just soldiers. These were essentially field scientists who were brought into the national parks. And that mantle was passed on literally to the National Park Service when it was created in 1916. So when I think of Charles Young, I see a transition figure, and it gives us a blueprint and a biography to who we used to be and who we still are to a great degree today.
Ravier, as a descendant of this remarkable man, why is it so important to keep his legacy alive, to keep his memory alive? As an African American, you know, I can say that growing up, we don't learn these histories in school often. In researching this conversation, I was blown away by the story. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, why do you feel it's so important that we continue to have these conversations?
I think it's important for, as you were saying, as an African-American person hearing these stories. I think a lot of stories of historical minority men and women are not included in the history books. So you don't grow up hearing about them. And I know that from my family letting us all learn about Colonel Young and his story, it was inspiring to me and something that I often drew upon for strength throughout different phases of my life. It's a story of determination and perseverance in the face of obstacles. So I think it's important to keep the story alive, to inspire minorities, but it's also important to keep his story alive, because I think that you don't just have to be African-American or a minority to relate to his story, since it's one of perseverance. So it can be drawn upon from people from different walks of life, different ethnicities. I think it's important to keep that alive.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today, we're talking about the legacy of Charles Young, who was the first Black U.S. National Park superintendent. He will be honored in the Sequoia Kings Canyon National Park this Veterans Day. Brian, I would love for you to put Colonel Young's legacy into a broader historical context. How remarkable is his life story?
Yeah, so he was the third African-American to graduate from West Point, and the last for nearly a half a century. Shortly after he graduated West Point, really the prejudice and in America closed the doors to blacks at the military academy until Benjamin O. Davis Jr. graduated in 1936. So Young was a trailblazer for his race in the Army, and he was the only one. He went on to be the first black military attaché serving abroad at one of our embassies in Haiti. And he went on to serve two more tours in Liberia.
The legacy is remarkable.
And he attained the rank of colonel by the time World War I began, and by that time there were some medical issues and racial prejudice that prevented him from being the first black brigadier general.
So, Shelton, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that you are the only African-American ranger at Yosemite National Park today. And I'm curious, from where you sit, how much of an inspiration are stories like these? And how do you think these kind of stories can be leveraged to inspire more African-Americans and people of color to enjoy our national parks and to maybe follow in your footsteps?
Well, one thing that's important to keep in mind is that African Americans in general, we come out of a history of segregation rather than integration, of not being made to feel welcome in certain environments historically. So if you're growing up in an inner city urban area and you're African American and you hear about national parks, the first thing to keep in mind is that when you look at the history of national parks and tourism, the tourism traditionally was never inflected toward people of color, never specifically inflected toward African Americans because of our history of race and discrimination and so forth. So if you grow up in an African American family in an urban area such as I did in Detroit, you would not naturally think that places like Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon or Zion are environments that are specific to you and your culture. So when you hear a story about Charles Young, the third African-American to graduate from West Point, who was superintendent of Sequoia National Park in 1903, and this, of course, is fully a decade before the creation of the National Park Service itself, well, that awareness contradicts everything that you've been led to believe about your own ethnicity and the role of your ethnicity and your culture with regard to the national park idea. And so it is a revolutionary perception. It is a revolutionary inception to have that thought that people who look like me were running a national park or working in a national park before the creation of the National Park Service itself. Because what you'll find, in a very vernacular way, you find that many African Americans have this thought that national parks aren't for us, they're not about us. And when you come out of that history of Jim Crow, where it was very difficult just to move freely, you know, that's why the Green Book was invented, literally, mm-hmm. was so that we would have this sense of safety and security. Well, if you come out of the opposite of that and don't feel safe in rural environments because of that history of Jim Crow, the KKK, and so forth, why would you think that it would be a wonderful experience to take your family to Montana or Wyoming and go to Yellowstone, or to go to rural California or the wild aspect of California, which can be found in Sequoia National Park and Yosemite National Park, because they're essentially, in a purest sense, wilderness environments. So hearing this story creates a pathway, a cultural pathway, that gives you a sense of safety, gives you a sense of security, but more importantly, it gives you a sense of cultural rootedness. And that is a profound thing, to imagine an environment like Yosemite or Sequoia and yet feeling that that's my home, that's my cultural North Star. I mean, the path to freedom may have been going north, but maybe the path to freedom also leads into the West, and it leads to environments like these environments, because now you have that rootedness in them because of a history that was unknown that's now being told.
So, Ravier, I want to give you the last word. I understand that one of the biggest legacies that Young left on the park system was the management of road construction, which is literally what has enabled so many of us to participate in these beautiful treasures of our nation. Given that, I think it's so fitting that the tribute that you will be a part of on Veterans Day is naming a portion of Highway 198 in Charles Young's honor. Can you just speak from a family perspective about what that moment is going to feel like for you?
Yes, we're very honored and proud to have the road renamed after him. I think it's a, as you were saying, true testament to the work that he and the time that he dedicated to our country and the national parks. I think it also kind of what Shelton hit on a little bit earlier about bringing awareness, especially to minorities and inner cities, of that the national parks is a place for them. I think that having the road renamed really means a lot from that aspect as well, and just gives a lot more visibility to not only the fact that he was the first African-American colonel, but also his involvement with the national parks. So I see it as a way of keeping his story alive and bringing awareness to it.
Well, we appreciate you all being with us today so we can talk a bit about his story and share it with a larger audience. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Laura Satsui. Since 2014, Kern County sheriffs have been putting more inmates into isolating suicide watch cells. The effort is to reduce suicide rates, but it hasn't helped. I spoke with ProPublica's Ryan Gabrielson and Jason Pohl from the Sacramento Bee to find out why. The two reporters are investigating California's jails this year to see what's changed since the state implemented realignment. Jason Pohl begins by explaining what brought the pair to Bakersfield.
One of the ways that we identified Kern County as a place that we wanted to spend some reporting energy was in looking at these annual or biannual state inspection reports. Essentially, what these are the State Board of Community Corrections going into the jails across the state every 2 years and conducting inspections to see, among other things, are policy manuals up to date, are some of the practices that are being employed at the jails up to the minimum standards. And when we started looking through those reports, we quickly found a pretty unusual phrase, three words called suicide watch overflow. And that piqued our interest and made us want to know a little bit more about this process called suicide watch overflow. And so we began looking at a little bit more of the data behind Kern County's suicides and found that, in fact, they have had one of the highest suicide rates among county jail systems in the state of California. And once we had those two pieces put together, we quickly knew that, in fact, we should plan a trip to Bakersfield.
This is Ryan, just to piggyback on Jason's great details. And most of the inspection reports, as we went through them, they just contained very little. And there was sort of checking of boxes, a stamping of forms. This one for Kern County felt differently. There were details about the nature of the concerns, and it reached across the divide from just what the standards say into questions about the safety of the operational practices in the Kern County Jail.
Yeah, and if I kind of interpreted what you guys wrote or read and kind of understood your story correctly, the overflow rooms, I think that's in reference to some of these, like, closet-sized rooms, and they were supposed to solve a problem of, like, not having enough other suicide watch isolation rooms. Is that right?
So the way, this is Ryan, the way the Kern County Sheriff's Office does it, and some other county jails do it, is they have a very limited number of regular suicide watch cells, which are pretty small and spare on their own. When those fill up, they will oftentimes turn to a different type of cell that is even emptier, I guess you should say, we would say, because it doesn't even have toilets. It's just four walls and a grate in the floor, and those are called safety cells. Those are supposed to be very short-term holding spaces for people who are basically damaging property in the jail and hurting themselves and are a threat to others, are placed for a short time to stabilize. What was different about the Kern County setup is that they were providing yoga mats to people they put in safety cells, using it as suicide watch, meaning the yoga mats were to be mattresses that people were to sleep on, meaning safety cells were no longer just a few hours. They were days and even more than a week.
Yeah, that was something that came up a lot, and I read about in sort of the ProPublica's newsletter as well, was yoga mats and kind of the brand of them, TheraBand. I don't know, that really stuck out to me because it seemed like an odd thing as an alternative to the mattress. Did anybody ever give you a very clear answer about why yoga mats?
This is Jason. So it stuck out to you, and it also stuck out to that state inspector who wrote that term, suicide watch overflow. One of the things that Kern County was cited for the most that year was their use of these TheraBand yoga mats or exercise mats in these cells. And when we toured the jails earlier this summer, a couple months ago, we saw that they were still using them. And when we questioned a couple of the jail staff about why they were using these, they said that they didn't want to issue inmates mattresses, actual mattresses, because they were afraid that it was a barricading risk, that inmates on suicide watch could use them to barricade the doors. However, it's worth noting that only suicide watch inmates are given yoga mats. And in fact, after we started asking questions, the jail stopped using yoga mats altogether.
You mentioned just now that the yoga mat stuck out to the inspector, but it almost sounds like that didn't even, I guess, motivate them to change out the yoga mats for mattresses. It was once you guys came around and asked questions, which leads me to wonder, like, what can the state do about this?
This is Ryan. That's an excellent question. And it's true that Kern County Sheriff's Office, in response to the findings, basically said, we disagree and we're going to continue doing things our way. We requested their purchasing records for products that used on suicide watch, including the yoga mats, and found that they were continuing to order dozens and dozens of additional mats into April, which is when they finally responded to the state's inspection. The inspection itself did not deter them at all. So the state jail standards are voluntary. They are not regulation. They are not enforceable. And the state agency that oversees county jails and realignment across the state has no enforcement authority. They don't do enforcement. So when they come down with a report, it is entirely up to the local jurisdiction, the local agencies, whether they will follow or not.
The people that you spoke with at the Kern County jails, the sheriff's deputies, you know, behavioral health employees, did they realize that their suicide rates were oddly high compared to the rest of the state in the jail?
This is Jason. And no, they did not seem to realize that their rates were some of the highest in the state. Part of that is because, as they explained it to us, they have not done any sort of comprehensive look at suicides in the jail over the past several years. There's been no sort of broader study looking at what commonalities some of these cases have or how some of these could have been potentially prevented. These are handled in isolated cases one at a time, and in some cases, behavioral health might not be communicating much at all directly with the sheriff's office when there's a suicide that doesn't happen under their watch. And so that lack of study is something that was sort of striking to us as we kept looking more at the relationship between the two.
And indeed, this is Ryan. Nearly all of the suicide deaths that have occurred the past several years in the Kern County jails took place away from suicide watch, and these were individuals who were not, their risk was not identified or was overlooked in some important way, and it is unclear whether the county's behavioral health agency was even tracking them as a patient.
Okay, and this is just one story in many that you've done in your series called Overcorrection about jails and oversight. And so I'm wondering, like, has your work gotten other lawmakers to say, hey, we need to make some different sorts of changes, you know, make it so that the state can actually come down hard on issues like this?
This is Jason. I think we're still sort of in that moment where we're waiting to see what the reaction will be from lawmakers. In our story that came out this week, Senator Nancy Skinner said that there needed to be some reviews and revisions to the state's oversight of county jails. It's unclear what exactly that revision might look like or what sort of process might unfold, but she was on record saying that things need to change. And then also Governor Gavin Newsom express concern about how the county can hold people in isolation indefinitely. But again, we haven't heard any specifics on how things may or may not change in the years ahead.
This is Ryan. And a complicating factor is something that came that was sort of built into realignment itself, is that any reform, any regulation, any new law that is imposed from the state onto local jurisdictions, if that causes a cost increase on the local agency, the state has to pay that. So there's been a lot of resistance, and there have been multiple bills that passed both houses. houses of the California legislature vetoed over concerns that the state would have to bear the cost of improving conditions or stopping some bad practice at the local jails.
And this isn't the first story you've put out to look at a Central Valley facility. A couple other stories looked at Fresno County jails. And because I'm in the Central Valley and our listeners are in the Central Valley, is that just a coincidence that some of your stories have focused here? Or do you notice a difference between Central Valley law enforcement and others in the state?
This is Jason. I'll start that one, and I'm sure Ryan will have something to add as well. But part of the origin of this project, it's a partnership between the Sacramento Bee and ProPublica as part of their local reporting network. And the question that initially got this whole project started was, how have jails changed since realignment happened? And we here at the Sacramento Bee also are partner papers with publications in Fresno and Merced. And one of the motivating factors was, you know, let's put some reporting muscle into those communities where perhaps there's not the same level of newsroom staff anymore. Perhaps there's a need to shine some more reporting spotlight on issues that may have not been addressed sufficiently in recent years. And so that's part of the reason a lot of our series has focused on Central Valley facilities and sheriff's offices. But we've also gone where the data takes us, and as Ryan can attest, a lot of that has led us to places in Fresno and Merced, and most recently Bakersfield.
Yeah, this is Ryan. To echo Jason, we keep trying to find our way to a beachside community, but there's not a ton of reliable data on conditions and outcomes from the county jails and what happens to people who go inside. But one of the more solid, because if you know there's just no way around it, is deaths. And deaths in the cells keep leading us back to the Central Valley.
All right. And on that note, we have to wrap it up. But Jason Pohl of the Sacramento Bee and Ryan Gabrielson of ProPublica are the reporting team behind Overcorrection. It's a collaboration between the outlets about what they call crises in California jails. You can find more of their reporting online. I'm sure we will look forward to reading more to come as well. But Jason and Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks.
Our pleasure.
And now for the weekend. Today marks the start of the 15th annual Fresno Filmworks Film Festival at the Tower Theater. The three-day event includes several feature-length films, including the political documentary Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins, about the Texas maverick and national political commentator known for her razor-sharp wit. And on Sunday, five film shorts with Central Valley connections. Today in our studio, we have Dr. Mark Lasher. He's the focus of one of those short films, The Clinic, about the free needle exchange and mobile medical clinic he's run in Fresno for about two decades. And on the phone, we have the filmmaker Olivia Shaw. Welcome, both of you. Olivia, let's start with you. You like filmmaking that questions our cultural identities and social systems. One of your desires is to break barriers between people, so it makes sense you did The Clinic. But how did you find it in the first place?
I knew that I wanted to do a film about the opioid epidemic, but I wanted to do one that was focused not so much on the individual overcoming or dealing with addiction, but on a way to move forward and the responsibility of healthcare to move us forward and doctors to move us forward and the institutions of healthcare to move us forward. And so I was reading the Fresno Bee and read an article about Dr. Lasher, and I just thought that the world that he had created at this clinic was totally unique and different from anywhere else I had read about. And then I called him, kind of just cold called him, and he was like, come on down, you know, sort of to see if I could handle it and sort of if I fit in. So I just went down to Fresno and kind of had this amazing experience, and people were so welcoming, and I felt like it was this really unique space that also, if I handled myself correctly, I could really make a powerful film in.
So, Mark, tell us a little bit about the clinic.
Well, everyone that comes to the clinic is an active injecting drug user. The draw to the clinic is that just outside of our mobile bus unit, which is the medical unit, just outside under awnings, is the needle exchange. And Dallas Blanchard heads up the needle exchange. He's been doing that for over 22 years or so, maybe 23 years. And people bring in their used needles and get clean ones that haven't been used. The exchange is open for 2 hours every Saturday from 1 to 3. Medical care goes on for a few more hours because it takes a lot more time. And in that time, Dallas exchanges approximately every week now about 20,000 needles.
The film is kind of a day in the life of this clinic, and the topic is heartbreaking no matter how you look at it, but the film isn't. It's more uplifting. And one of the reasons for that, Mark, is your interactions with your patients. So let's play a clip where you're dealing with someone who's a little testy and you're trying to get some information out of her so you can refer her to
getting
a dermatologist.
Getting into dermatology clinic, the referral, and say, we'll try to get the closest appointment possible.
I'll call and make an appointment. No.
You won't get in.
Why?
They don't do that.
Dermatology clinics?
They do.
How about dermatology clinics?
It has to be. You have to be referred in. Okay. What's your phone number? Do you have a cell number? Can't refer you. What's your social security number?
I'm not giving you my social security number. What's your social security number?
106.
Oh my God. You can't have social security.
Okay.
What the heck? Seriously?
Yeah. Do you have Medi-Cal?
No, but I qualify for it.
Okay, let's get you signed up for Medi-Cal, because they'll need you.
Can I do that here?
What?
Can I do that right here today?
No.
When do I have to do that?
Okay, so here's Blackstone. This is Shields.
So there's such a humanity to this film that we're hard-pressed to find on a daily basis. Maybe both of you can speak to that a little bit.
As I see the film and I see what's happening in there, I see that I use my notes as a way that I could, get into what people are dealing with, but yet not get so close that I feel their pain. And there's a lot of pain, and there's a lot of stuff that people are dealing with, and it's like being in Sherwood Forest. We're out there to help each other, and with our skills, the ones that we have, whether it's feeding those who are hungry, Food Not Bombs just a block away from us, or whether it's putting up housing in Echo Village, all those things. Everyone does their part. This is I'm trained to provide medical arts. This is what I'm trained in. This is what I could provide.
Olivia, what do you think about the humanity of this film?
Well, I mean, that it's a great compliment to hear you say that, so I appreciate that. And I mean, that's really my motivation when I make films, the type of films that I make, is that I feel like the camera gives me this sort of special ability to kind of break down some barriers that maybe I, as a human being alone, when I'm not making a film, wouldn't in my daily life. Part of the motivation was that this is clearly an issue that's all around us, no matter where we live. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm not able to kind of get deep into what's going on with an individual. And so I felt like this was my chance. And I think that there is something about a camera sometimes, if wielded correctly and respectfully, can really like allow people to open up. And I also thought, particularly in this space, what I found was that people really wanted someone who was going to listen to them without judgment. And I think Dr. Lasher does an amazing job of that. And so I sort of wanted to translate that for the camera. And that was, I think, why a lot of people said they would participate, because I was able to have a conversation with them and learn more before filming.
I like the way you start it with Mark driving the bus, the mobile clinic, to the place where it operates. And then you end it with him driving the bus away. And I'm wondering, what was the reason for that? Why didn't you just stay at the clinic?
Well, I felt like it was such a big part of the reality, I guess, of the space. And I really wanted to show the Central Valley a lot more in the film. And I spent tons of time filming what I believe are these really beautiful landscapes that are around Fresno. And that kind of didn't make it, as you know, that fell away in the editing, sadly. And I have all this footage I really want to use. But I felt like I needed to show the space around as much as possible, and kind of show that this was something that he has, I don't know, his little trip to and from the clinic on Saturdays felt like this really important sort of entry point and exit point. And I think he expends so much energy on that day. And I just thought these were really beautiful, quiet moments, like kind of going in and coming home. And when I was filming one of the drives home at night and he took off his gloves while he was driving, I was like, that's the end to the film. Like, I, you know, sometimes when you're filming and you see something happen, rarely, but sometimes you're like, oh, I know exactly where that's going. I kind of like the instinct kicked in a little bit.
Right. It was kind of like almost like bookends.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And bookends are always great for film structure.
And then there was one scene where a kid who shows up with a injury on his head, and he obviously doesn't really belong at the clinic. He belongs in the ER. And you, Mark, you have to go out and kind of rescue him. And I assume that you must have this sort of word of mouth reputation for being a good guy who can be trusted, that sometimes you're put in a bind.
With that fellow, I wasn't, you know, because it was an issue of violence, he got beat over the head pretty bad. And I'm not sure how well you could see, but we were actually stapling up his scalp. And he didn't know very much about what happened to him. And so there wasn't, you know, and in my decision making, do I contact the authorities or not? You know, and it just, with him not knowing what happened to him, that made the decision pretty easy for me. It was just take care of the medical issue at hand, get him well, and get him on his way.
Well, my guess is you'd have to have sort of a myopic focus doing the job you do, because the ripple effect of drug use and, I guess, other reasons for coming to the clinic, that's huge. So you're really kind of focusing on just one specific thing. And I think that sort of is where the humanity sort of shows up.
Yeah. And, you know, and there's so many things that, you know, that take place, the family members, you know, like work, not work, living situation, all of that. And no, you just have to deal with what's in front of us. And, you know, like we also deal with the policies, you know, like in our community, you know, like, and sometimes you just have to put that all aside and just deal with the person in front of you. And you're going, okay, we'll deal with those maybe Monday through Friday, or hopefully, but our Monday through Fridays are pretty packed.
Well, that intimacy is what the film does so beautifully. So thank you so much for being here, Dr. Mark Lasher, and thank you so much, Olivia Shaw, for joining us on the phone.
Thank you for covering us and letting people know we're out there, and welcome to our rabbit hole.
The Clinic and other film shorts with Central Valley connections will screen this Sunday at 1 p.m. at the Tower Theater. Admission to the shorts is free. And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kvpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR News Team, Monica Velez and Alice Daniel,
Laura Satsui, and Carrie Klein. Technical support from Marv Ellen and Don Weaver. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, presenting Trade-Offs, a new podcast that tries to make sense of a costly and complicated healthcare system. Subscriptions on your app or at tradeoffs.org.